Copyright in these lectures is either owned by the ANU or a third party who has licensed the ANU to use it. Students may use the recording for personal study only. No lecture may be communicated online, copied or shared without the prior permission of the ANU.
Looks like it, but it'd be good if you could sit down the front.
What about down there, Rod?
Otherwise, you're going to be right up the back.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, goodness, I don't think have we got the titles of your paper? Excellent.
I haven't even had a chance to look at the abstract.
Yes, we do. What am I talking about? Okay. So, good morning. I think it's still morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to get this session underway. My name is Roger Markwick, and I'm chairing this particular session, which, for those of you who haven't read the guide, is entitled The Russian Revolution. Actually, the whole thing, A Century of Communist and Post-Communist Development. So we have three speakers today, and our first speaker is Dr. Roderick Pitty. Rod is an expert, really, I think, in, I'd say, international relations, if I'm not misrepresenting him. And he'll be speaking today on the theme of the Russian Revolution and the world capitalist system and historical assessment. Okay, over to you, Rod. Okay,
thank you, Roger. Now, it's very pleasing for me to be here, even though I was late. It's less like to get trodden on or actually lost there. And my apologies to Professor Kazantsev for missing the first section of your paper. I had to come from over 100 kilometres away. And the windscreen was frozen completely because I forgot to put the cloth that was there to prevent that happening on the windscreen. So my apologies. It's very pleasing to be at a second conference on Russia at ANU within a year. Dorothy organised the conference last August, and now we have another one. And this is actually quite significant for anyone who knows the history of Russian study at this university, particularly as it was developed by late Professor Harry Rickley. So he would be very pleased about this. I did a thesis which actually connects with some of the things that were on in the previous session, on what was called Soviet development debates, and I'll only from memory refer to a few things in passing. But this was done 30-odd years ago. And I started out, and it relates to what Roger said, as sort of coming at it from the point of view of an international relations person. There was an Israeli who wrote a book called The Meshdu Narodniki. I've even not quite remembered his name. It's in the library, unless they've tossed it out. The previous vice-chancellor at the university that I have been associated with, and I won't go into that, that's a long story, on the other side of the continent, actually made the astounding comment some years ago that students can't be expected to read books. Anyway, the title of the book was The Meshdu Narodniki. It was published sometime in 1979, and it was about people such as Professor Georgi Ilyich Mirsky, who passed away in January last year, aged 90 years old, and who was the leading Soviet expert on the Middle East. particularly the Arab countries. And that the book was about the influence that these people may have had on Soviet foreign policy and decision-making. And that's the framework through which I started to analyse the work of these significant Soviet intellectuals. And it dawned on me, perhaps later rather than sooner, that there was something else that was more significant than the influence or the prevalence of the ideas. And this relates a bit to some of the discussion at the end of the previous session. And that is the significance of the ideas themselves. You can have ideas that are very popular and prevalent, Australia's an example, and they can be rubbish. And we should actually be interested in ideas that are significant as intellectuals. What was significant about many of these Mezhnarodniki is that they were operating on two levels. One, as advisors about what was happening in the Third World. It's interesting that Graham brought up the Third World in the question mark. There's an article by Mirsky, which was a sort of a memoir about the life of an Orientalist in Khrushchev and Brezhnev's Russia. And what he said about the study of the Third World, why was it so interesting? It was so interesting because dogma could not be so easily imposed there. Any study of what was the Soviet Union, publicly or officially, was completely censored. Any study of Western capitalist society was completely dogmatic because there was a set view and you had to repeat it. What was the developing world or the Third World was changing, and the old Soviet leadership actually needed some idea of what was happening, and partly through the role of significant, in a sense, academic directors, there was then an area or a space for debate, even well before Gorbachev, about what was really happening in the Third World, because it was so dynamic, and that created a space for a hidden or a Sopian debate about the nature of Russia as a society. Now, in fact, that's not what I'm really talking about, but that's just background. So, I don't have PowerPoint, and I'm sorry if you like PowerPoint. I've got an index card, which was written up during the question time for Andrei's presentation, because circumstances have been very difficult. It's been actually hard for me, for various reasons, I won't actually go into them, to even get here, but I made it. And there are seven headings that I'll talk about, and they are not like the days of the week. They are not of the same length. But the seven headings are different periods about the Russian Revolution and the world capitalist system. And in case you miss the main theme, or I don't actually remember to say it, the main theme is this. The Russian Revolution was a real revolution. It had world historical significance. So that links with what was said in some of the discussion after Andrei's session. But it was defeated. It was defeated thoroughly, absolutely, and completely within a generation, or even less. And the impact of that defeat has had a very lasting legacy. So that's the overall argument. Now, I'll try to go... Some of this is just going to be a bit of a sketch, going through things very quickly, and it's covering quite a lot. The first word, so I'll go through the words so in case, just to make sure I get to the end. Some of them, the first half of it, up until word four, or phrase four, is more developed than the rest of it. Actually, that's the most significant. The last three categories are rather less defined than the first four. The first category is origins, so the origins of the Russian Revolution in relation to the world capitalist system. The second category is the nature of the October Revolution. In a sense, I'm focusing on the Bolshevik Revolution, which was the focus here. I did wonder this morning, when I was struggling with the windscreen, why the conference was scheduled in middle of winter rather than in late October. But never mind. I presume perhaps the Central Committee decided there were two revolutions and would choose halfway in between. The first heading is the origins of the revolution. Second one is October Revolution. The third heading, it's already been mentioned, Stalinism. It's a very complicated and actually not just a Russian phenomenon, even though that was the origins of it. The fourth category, and even if I only get to the fourth category, because we've probably only got a bit over 10 minutes left, that is the most important in a sense and the most complicated. The fourth category is the Cold War. And the Cold War, the argument is simply this. There was a Cold War, it finished, but it has a legacy, and there is no new Cold War. And I'll try to explain the reason for that. I've had some correspondence with Roger about it, very cryptically. But that's quite a significant argument. The fifth category is Glasnost. Sixth category is what Richard Sackville calls the Cold Peace, which is not a new Cold War. It's a hangover from the old Cold War. The last category, if I get to it, is something that used to be called the general crisis of capitalism, even in old Soviet texts, where it was meaningless. But it may actually be a meaningful category in the last decade and in future decades because of the nature of the world. Okay, Gramsci described the Bolshevik Revolution as a revolution against das Kapital, not just against capitalism, which it was clearly a revolution against capitalism, but a revolution against the expectations that might have been drawn from reading Das Kapital. And I'm not sure that that's really right, because that reads it in a national context. And the fundamental thing that was mentioned about the revolution earlier, I think, is there are many things, but one is the global context. People talk about globalization. It's been around for a long time in a significant form. There's a good little book by Jeffrey Baraclough, An Introduction to Contemporary History, published in the early 60s, and he says globalization, he didn't use the term, but that's it, started in the 1890s. In other words, there was a global context, not just a European, but a global, but particularly European context to the Russian Revolution. Now, Lenin wrote many books. Three were at least significant in terms of the origins of the Russian Revolution. And he might have been wrong about one of them. He might have been wrong even about two of them. But he wasn't wrong about the third one. The ones he might have been wrong about was the development of capitalism in Russia. He might have exaggerated that. That's part of an argument. He might have been wrong about his expectations for the withering away of the state in State and Revolution, written in 1917. He might have been wrong in the sense of expecting how readily that could be done, although that links to a certain core assumption I'll come to very quickly. He wasn't wrong about the other book published, I think, in 1916, Imperialism, the Higher Stage of Capitalism, and the expectation that the revolution might occur in the weakest point of the chain. That's at least the thing he got right. Okay, so the origins, you need to understand that the nature of the global capitalist system then, partly to put the revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution in context. Moving right along quickly. October. What was the assumption of everyone, more or less everyone, in the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party at the time of the February Revolution? There were, in a sense, two assumptions. One, that the dominant assumption was that the revolution will not become socialist. And Lenin's impact was to challenge that assumption and say you could have a socialist revolution in such a backward country. But the other assumption was even more important. It was that the Russian Revolution could only succeed if it was a spark that inspired other revolutions in much more advanced industrialized societies, especially in Germany. So contra Churchill, that Lenin was basing his strategy on the assumption that a revolution in Russia would contribute to a revolution in Germany and then in other European countries. It was not only Lenin's assumption, it was the assumption of pretty well all the leadership. And that was what was overturned in the subsequent decade in terms of ideas, where with the so-called notion of socialism in one country, which in terms of Lenin's theory, in terms of Marx's theory, was complete nonsense. And yet it came to be believed. Now, we're running out of time.
No, we've got about 8 minutes or so.
In the article that Kirill put out in the Australian Institute of International Affairs, that's about one of the few things I've read in the last month because I've been moving house and various other things have been happening. It was a very significant article. But the one thing I would quibble about would be the categorisation of what the Soviet Union was as socialist. Because where does the categorisation actually come from? It comes from essentially Stalin and those who supported him. And there are a whole lot of people who were debating in the late Gorbachev period, before the Gorbachev period, who were questioning that. And one of them, perhaps the most significant in terms of a public Russian intellectual, was Professor Nadari Alexandrovich Simonia. And he published a book, I think in 1991, Что мы построили? What have we built? I think that's it. And he said, we haven't built socialism. He was actually demonstrating that very clearly. I had some sort of labels here or subheadings. And the subheading for Stalinism is sort of a bit Trumpian. Fake labels and false idols. there's a whole history about that, and Graham will talk more about it, perhaps. But the idea that you could actually build socialism or anything that was really socialism in a backward agrarian country was very strange to anyone in the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party at the start of 1917, and yet that became the dogma within a few years. Okay, Stalinism was bad enough. In Russia, as we've heard, people can sort of assess the actual demographics of it. But it was bad enough in Russia, but it didn't only affect Russia. It affected the whole world in the sense of putting a millstone around those who identify themselves with trying to create a more just and equal society. Now, I phrase that carefully and cryptically because there's no time to elaborate it. But Stalinism was bad enough, but it was not the end of it. It was the form of the defeat of the Russian Revolution, but not the end of it. There are two things that went together to ensure the defeat of the Russian Revolution. One was Stalinism, the whole complex process that developed in the Soviet Union and then expanded. The other was the Cold War. And at least I've got to the Cold War. Because this was something that is much more complex as a phenomenon than it's usually understood. It was not simply an aspect of diplomatic relations in any society. It was ramified right throughout the society. The British historian A.J.P. Taylor said, the Cold War was not expected to last, but it did. Now, why did it last? There are various interpretations, and one of the persuasive ones is a sort of functionalist one. And the question is asked by some people, who won the Cold War? And the simplistic answer is the United States in 1989, or the end of 1989. Even though, if you asked State Department senior diplomats 5 years before that, or even the year before that, they would say they hadn't even thought the Cold War would end. The answer to the question, who won the Cold War, is more complicated. It's the people in power on both sides until Gorbachev changed the policies. So the Cold War was won in a sense by Stalin as much by those in the United States and the American pro-American system. That's a sort of complicated argument. But the nature of the Cold War, the meaning of it, is actually in the phrase, as we experienced a bit this morning. It's a deep freeze of the political process. It was a freeze, in a sense, even in Russia. Even though you had the thaw, it's partly because of the nature of the Cold War, as well as internal reasons, that didn't develop. Now, a couple of other significant intellectuals, and then I'll try to sort of get quickly to the end. Vladimir Petrovich Lukin, at one stage, was Yeltsin's ambassador to the United States. and later on the ombudsman in Russia. In 1968, he was in Prague. He was radical enough to actually oppose the Soviet invasion and didn't end up in prison camps because he was supported by Arbatov, Georgi Arbatov, and Alexander Bodin, who had links to people in the elite. One of the most significant articles published in Russia in the 20th century is in the official journal Voprosy Filosofii in 1969, the June issue. And it's an article which appears to be about development in the Third World, the East, particularly Confucian societies, and the nature of ideology. And actually, it's at a double level. It's particularly about Stalinism. And he refers to the ruling ideology, Marxism-Leninism, as a word game. Not a set of beliefs, but simply a word game. I can't remember the full quote, but people play along with the words of the game, the meaning of which, he said, they no longer understood. Okay. Now, that changed in 1987. 86 and then 87 with Glasnost, which happens before the end of the Cold War, but it's crucial to the process that led to the end of the Cold War, which was entirely unilateral. And the last three categories are much less clear than the previous ones. But Glasnost lasted and was, for those of us who were around, it was wonderful. The problem is it didn't last long enough. And it's astounding that the type of public ignorance that exists in Russia today about the nature of Stalinism as a criminal regime, whatever quibble there is about the statistics in terms of demography, there's no doubt that it was a criminal regime in terms of shooting people and, you know, and the rest of it. I'm sort of getting sidetracked, but it's the fact that there was a debate that opened up under Gorbachev, but the legacy of that hasn't really continued. Now we're up to sort of 1 minute. Okay. October 1987, Viktor Leonidovich Shamus, who later became a parliamentarian, published an article saying more or less whatever he wanted. And at the start of that year, he wouldn't have believed that he could publish that article. In one of those, you know, in the article, he said the idea of a general crisis of capitalism that goes on for 70 years is a nonsense, which it is. You can't have a crisis that isn't actually resolved. But the last point is that the Russian Revolution was defeated through Stalinism. The defeat was sort of entombed through the Cold War, which I haven't sort of had time to fully elaborate. But we are not in a new Cold War now. There is a legacy or a hangover of the old Cold War. That's Karaganov's interpretation. Even Robert Legvold, who wrote a book, Return to Cold War, his argument can be interpreted as a hangover interpretation rather than creating a new Cold War. If it was a new Cold War, then the whole political system would be frozen as it was in the old Cold War. That is not the case. It's not the case, and Andrei referred to the socialists in Russia, the genuine socialists, as a very small group and very young. No doubt that's true, but that's exactly what largely the Bolsheviks were in 1917. And because time's up, I'll just leave you with that thought and answer any questions when time comes around.
Okay, so, excuse me. Thank you very much, Rod. Rod has certainly set the scene for the broad kind of discussion that we should be having, and it seems like the question of the new Cold War will undoubtedly be part of that discussion. So, our next speaker. Well, thank you. He's using PowerPoint.
Yeah, he's well lucky.
Yep. Where is it? Good, please. Our next speaker is Dr. Milenko Petrovich, who's senior lecturer at the University of Canberra. Slight slip of the tongue. University of Canterbury in New Zealand. A return to communism is not a solution, is Dr. Petrovich's presentation today. Over to you, sir.
Thank you. So how much time I have?
20 minutes, and I'll give you...
Because 25 or 28 minutes was for the previous speaker. So
No, that's not correct.
This is correct. We started 25 to 12.
I'll give you 20 minutes, please.
Then I will not speak.
Sorry?
No, I will not speak.
I'm quite happy to accommodate...
No, you are not chairing as you have to chair.
No, I did. I checked it. We started... If
we
you're
started
going
25 to 12. I can't have enough of speaking shortly for the people...
Dr. Petrovich, please, it would be really good... I am sure people have come quite a considerable way to hear people such as yourself. I did check very carefully. You may have noticed I gave Dr. Pitti 20 minutes. We began a little bit late. That's why it looks like he was supposed...
We started 25 to 12.
Please do take the forum, because I'm sure that people would like to hear what you have to say.
Sorry for that, but... I wanted to speak about something that Dr. Pitti wanted to speak about, but I think he didn't have time speaking about the crisis of current capitalism, and I think that we are thinking of the similar things. I'll speak the consequences of the current crisis of capitalism, which is seen as a consequence of globalization, and which actually appears to happen after the collapse of communism. So this new peace, the end of, as Fukuyama was speaking of civilization, the beginning of the new civilization, end of the Cold War, end of conflicts, end of communism, as the world order, so the win of capitalism should have bring, global world into one, and without those conflicts and so on, with better life for everyone. And it was expectation in Soviet Union in particular, and from Gorbachev, Dr. Pitti said, practically unilaterally capitulated with glasnost and starting to that process of glasnost and openness, or so-called democratization of the political system, which cannot be democratized. That was his mistake, expecting that socialism can be democratic, or at least socialism led by one party or monopolistic view can be democratic. So, system collapsed and communism ended, and in this map, which I use in my presentation, you can see all the countries which used to be communist, and some of them are still communist, during the 20th century and after. Maybe somebody put in some other map is Bolivia, who copied the Venezuelan system in the recent decades, as also one pro-communist or very communist-type-led country. Basically, these are the countries, whatever is discussion of communism, starting from Marx and Lenin. That's what we have on our planet as a system that was so-called real socialism, as actually defined in Eastern European books, and by the leaders, actually, textbook and the leaders of the system, sometime in 1970s. That should have been the first stage of Marx's idea of communism, its two stages, the final end of this, of development of human society, of his materialistic approach to the human society, to the history of human society. But in practice, of course, it was maybe the first stage, In any respect, it was the dictatorship of proletariat, as it should have been according to Marx, but actually was dictatorship of the group of people or who led those parties and led those countries, with some diversification and changes. The most important diversification is in China, which is the country which is, after the collapse of communism, actually coincided during the 90s, a switch to the system when we have still communist dictatorship of the party, but of the party as a whole, not of the group of people within the party, who changed quite successfully. For three times they changed the leadership, or four times after Deng established that system. While in the other communist countries we have one leader or group of leaders as a pattern who rule the countries on behalf of themselves, saying that they are ruling on behalf of society, on working class and so on, until they died. With, of course, exception of Khrushchev, and unfortunately Khrushchev, who was overthrown through the as a consequence of the Cuban crisis, and of course Gorbachev, who went wrong himself with his policy. Now, all of that ended, of course, as we know, with the collapse of communism. As I said, as I fully agree with Dr. Pitti's definition of cold peace, which he have currently. It was in the 90s not cold peace, because Yeltsin was the full player living and close with the West, America, and so, but something happened, and that is what Dr. Pitti did not notice in his interpretation. He didn't mention economic development, which was quite important thing, and that what keynote speaker mentioned earlier, that successes of the communism regarding the practically moving society from agricultural towards the more advanced, actually doing the process of so-called industrialization and urbanization very quick, very and relatively successful in all of the countries you see on the map, with some differences in African and Latin American countries, China, Russia, Soviet Union, I mean, very successful urbanization and industrialization, basic industrialization of society, including Eastern European countries as well. I don't know why they put Western Germany. So this is a big mistake. Western Germany is communist. It's never been communist, of course. Country, but maybe they have a system which is the future, which I will try to mention by the end of my presentation. So three decades of globalization and increasing inequality of income and wealth, that was first part of my presentation, which I will be speaking as a consequence of this new development, which actually appeared to be beneficial only on a very small proportion of the people living on that planet, all around in those countries who were communist and who had never been communist, who never have been communist. And then from that raised the idea among the many leftist groups, some and politicians, some academics, intellectuals, students in particular, so-called millennial generations. I would say that at least three quarters of them around the planet are feeling themselves as a very leftist and revolutionary, cannot stand this system. You remember this protest. Every few years we have some movement, or every few months, I mean, that overthrow Wall Street. What was the name of
Occupy.
This?
Occupy.
Occupied Wall Street a few years ago. Then again, which looks to be very, very important and so on, but actually lost on its own energy. So, and I will then just very briefly give you my idea of what is the solution of this crisis in the world, because war, I mean, everyone would agree, whatever is his or her opinion, leftist, rightist, centrist, pro-communist, pro-capitalist, or pro-ultra-rightist, if you wish, that the world is now not better place, or not much better place than it used to be in 1989, 1990, when communism collapsed. At least for the large portion of population, even for the working class and the middle class in most advanced countries, and this is the problem of these 3 decades of globalization. Speaking about globalization, of course, in the term of which that have that process of spreading economy without borders, I mean, free trade agreements, I mean, and movement of capital and people, which actually were development of the world economy under the supremacy of the multinational companies and the people who led those companies. So, and I will remind you of two books. One is almost brand new. Branko Milanović, expert of the World Bank, wrote a book of globalization and inequalities, a very new one, and Stiglitz, I mean a Nobel Prize winner, economist Stiglitz, who wrote a lot of books, several books, and his most famous one, Globalization and its Discontent. And then he also wrote last year a very interesting book, just a moment, it's interesting too. The Price of Inequality. Speaking, he was the chief economist in the World Bank, I mean, in the late 1990s, and actually he explained how these world centers of financial capital and economic power, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, have actually spread that idea of neoliberalism, also free market economy, free movement of people, of capital, and so on, but mostly that led to the free movement of capital and the dominance of multinational companies, which actually led to an enormous increase of inequalities, and consequences that the richest countries in the world, middle classes started to disappear, shrink enormously, while on the other hand, the rise in wealth happened only to 1 or few percent at most of the people. And in Branko Milanović's book, you will find the details, data, data in detail about that development. While in Stiglitz's book, I think that book was reprinted definitely was the second edition, 2009 or even third, when he provided some new data, he more speaks about this mechanism, how this power of the multinational capital and centers of the people who led that in Washington actually spread that idea of neoliberalism through this international organization to most of the countries in the world, and which led to the, as I said, the enormous increase of income disparities. So, apart from China and a few, I would say, very regulated Asian countries, you know, Asian tigers plus, Korea, I mean, exclude Japan from that, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Arab countries who were rich with oil. None of the countries in the world, looking back at that map, improved that position regarding or come closer to the most advanced countries in the world regarding GDP per capita or living standard of most of the people since 1970s, 1960s. While, on the other hand, the middle class in America, in not that much in Western Europe, and this is important, but still in to some extent in Western Europe as well, Australia and New Zealand, these most advanced countries, middle class started to lose the ground and did not improve its position almost for anything. In America is definitely GDP per capita, wages and salaries of the middle class workers are almost in real terms at the same level as they used to be in 1970s, today, 40 years later. While on the other hand, the you can find this data in Milanovic's book, for example, the part of the wealth of which is possession of 1% of people in America quadrupled, for that period of time, in these 40 years. China has some results. As I said, these small Asian countries, few of them, and that led to some development of ideas, as I said, among the leftist groups, not only in America and developing countries, that maybe Chinese model is the future. Chinese is still communist, but reform significantly, particularly in economic terms. And then also they started to glorify some heroes from the communist past, actually the idea of communism as such, as maybe it is now the way to bring these things back, to somehow give more power, more economic power and actually wealth to most of the people, not only just one group of the people, which led to our the idea of capitalism. So, even some political leaders in the West, like, for example, Justin Trudeau, Canadian Prime Minister, said when Castro died last year, Cubanian communist dictator and leader for 40 years, that he was a larger than life leader who served his people for almost half a century. Obama, the previous American president, also tried to improve relations with Cuba. As you know, he paid a visit to Castro's brother, who continued to rule the country democratically as his brother did. Then Che Guevara remains an inspirational figure as a revolutionary who can overthrow imperialism and that rule of this top 1%. For many, not only in Latin America, but as I said, among the younger and left generation throughout the world, and you have several articles here in Independent 2006, New York Times 2007, the Epoch Times 2017 wrote similar articles about that. So what about the return to communism as an option? Communism, which existed in Eastern European countries, as you know, was in political terms dictatorship. Not only Stalinist dictatorship, in all of the countries we have dictators. In some countries they were more brutal as Stalin was. In the other countries less brutal, but they were dictators, as he said. And mostly, in most countries, apart from Poland and Hungary, where communism was weak from the very beginning and difficult to find the roots, in all of the countries that finished as a personal dictatorship of one leader who was supported with the group and actually protected himself well with police system, the role of secret police, extremely important, army, and so on. Oppression of media, total control of media, education, censorship, and so on. That was communism in political terms. In economic terms, it was successful. It was centrally planned economy with some, because now I also have no time, although the previous speaker have said several times that he doesn't have time, and he continued speaking for 10 minutes, and he figured out that he is out of time, and you told him that he had enough time. Now I have 3 minutes time to speak. Don't you feel that I have speaking shorter than the previous presenter? So, in economic debt system was completely inefficient. There were some variation in Yugoslavia and Hungary who abandoned central and planned economy, but were not able to replace because they were a communist dictatorship who controlled economy as such, and communist leaders wanted to continue controlling the economy. So market economy does not go together and very well with political oppression and political dictatorship. So all the reforms were useless in such a system. Even Yugoslavia, as I said, and Hungary, who reformed itself significantly, they were enormously behind Western countries. You can see in this table, which I, of course, don't have time to comment, that Yugoslavia, Romania, even Czechoslovakia, who was the most advanced country of the communist world before the war, you see that in 1937, 1938, how, for example, Czechoslovakia was close to some of the Western countries, Austria, Italy, or quite ahead of Portugal, and where was this country after the end of communism? This is the real numbers, GDP per capita in real measurement, and so excluding inflation and so on, and this is in absolute, I mean. Of course, the difference in absolute is much, much bigger, but in still in real numbers, in real so-called Gary Kamai dollars, as taken from the medicine history, economic history book, Czechoslovakia was almost double behind Austria and Italy after the end of communism, while before the communism was very close. However, the countries who were most backward, the Balkan countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, they were quite successful in the terms in comparison with the other communist countries, so they come closer to Czechoslovakia and Hungary who were ahead, but they all stayed, thanks to the successes of the first 15, 20 years of industrialization, actually, movement, which based on the movement of the people from the agriculture, from the rural areas toward the cities and find a job in new growing industries and cities, but they all stay enormously behind the West. So, what about the West and now the future of the world without commons? Just a few words about China, who many still, as I said, see as maybe this is some type of China is a specific country. I mean, they have enormous successes in economic terms, thanks to the cooperation with the West. Thanks to that the country is still in that period of first 10, 15 years in Eastern Europe of communism, where they are moving, I mean, population from a very backward rural area toward the cities, and based, as you know, the economic growth of enormously low payment for their working class. So that was good also in the Eastern Europe for the first 10, 15 years, but it is questionable how long it will stay. But still, of course, much better results economically China has. They have much bigger population. How they will finish in political terms, we will see. They also speaking about continuous reforms and democratization, gradual democratization of the countries, whether they will finish in debt or they will finish in collapse. In economic terms, Eastern European communism collapsed after 1970s. We will see in the next few decades. I think that they cannot continue in this way. I mean, and actually the results in the last few years show that this economic growth in China is also significantly slowing down. So, in the West, I think that we can defend two basic models. The Anglo-Saxon one, which insists on that neoliberalism, on minimal government, economic interventions, and small governments, low taxes, very weak trade unions and a small welfare state, on which grounds we have actually that process of globalization and spread of capitalism in that ways throughout the world. To the what about Stiglitz wrote in his book, as I mentioned. However, European Union and Central European, now most also ex-communist countries, who started to catch up, particularly those who joined European Union. You see very well Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, even Romania, Bulgaria in 2002, before they joined Union, where they were regarding GDP per capita in terms of the EU average, EU-27 average, they still catch up. We're able to make some catch-up. Not enormously big, but some of them quite significant. Slovakia from 54 go to 76. Hungary from 60, not that big. Lithuania, Latvia particularly significant. Lithuania from 45 to 72, Latvia 41 to 64. Romania also, we would like to say, very decent growth from 29 to 50, I'm finishing. And so that model in which we still have relatively strong trade unions, strong relationship between the government, workers through the trade unions and entrepreneurs, or capitalists if you wish, provide results. And we have, as somebody, keynote speaker mentioned, that the success of communism, and I agree, was enormously in that sense, as I said, in industrialization, making industrialization, education, and very speed growth. But also Western Europe industrialized itself significantly without communism from 1945 to 1978. For example, maybe you have forgotten that Italy had more than 30% of our agricultural population in 1945. And then by the 70s, they dropped to 6-7% without communism. French also have over 20% of agricultural population and then drop to all of them now have less than 5%. So the EU success, as I said, democratization in Eastern countries show that there is maybe the future in that model. Thank you.
So thank you very much, Milenko. It seems that the international aspects of this, of the Russian Revolution and its implications, will be very much part of the discussion that we're having, not only in this forum, but I dare say in others as well. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Graham Gill from the University of Sydney. Graham is Emeritus Professor of Government and Public Administration, and he will be speaking today on the development of executive power in Russia.
How long do I have? Thank you, Roger.
Liberal choice.
If we look at the topics of this session, I think it's what's clear is that we're moving like this, because we started off with the international dimension writ large, and then the international dimension slightly smaller, and now I'm going to look at the structure of executive power in Russia. So you can't get much more narrow than that. And what I'm going to do is to try and talk about the way in which the structuring of executive power after 1991 was a reaction against the Soviet experience, but it was also an attempt to take into account that Soviet experience. So I'll spend a little bit of time talking about the USSR, and then I'll move on to the more contemporary situation. I think in retrospect, if we look at the Soviet political system, we don't appreciate enough how historically innovative it actually was. This was the first political system anywhere that was established that was essentially run by a single party. There had been no attempt to organise a society in this way before. But also, if we look at the way in which the executive power within the Soviet Union was structured, it too was unique. And it was also, you've got to say, when you think about it, pretty strange. people who studied the Soviet Union saw this as being something that was normal. It wasn't normal. If you compare the way in which the top decision-making took place and the structure of that decision-making in the Soviet Union, it was very different from everywhere else in the world except those countries that were modelled upon the Soviet Union, that is China and Eastern Europe. And it was strange in a number of ways. Clearly, the main central institution of executive power within the USSR was the Party Politburo. Now, the Party Politburo was a body which was clearly directly attached to the Communist Party, but its connections with the government, which most people would see in the West as being the executive, were much more extended, strained, if you like, because there was no institutional linkage between the central decision-making body, that is the Politburo, and the government. At least that was the case after the initial years, first couple of years of the Soviet period, when Sovnarkom was the main decision-making body. The only linkage that there was between the two, only linkages that there were between the two, were one. Up until the Brezhnev period, the Politburo was actually chaired by the Prime Minister. Now, that in itself is a sort of an odd thing when you think about it, given that throughout most of this period, the Prime Minister was not the leading political figure in the Soviet Union. It was chaired by the Prime Minister. And I think that was simply an historical artifice that stemmed from Lenin's initial position. The other thing was that the government was at times represented on the Politburo by some government ministers. The numbers ranged over the whole Soviet period from a couple to one stage they were almost a majority. But so there was some representation. But the only thing which actually provided a directive power for the Politburo over the government were considerations of party discipline. There was no formal mechanism for the Politburo to actually instruct the government to do something. What they relied upon was this was the informality, if you like, of party discipline. Furthermore, what the Politburo did, or what the party did at the top level, was to develop almost a shadow administration, shadowing the ministries. This was in the form of the Central Committee Secretariat. The Central Committee Secretariat was divided into departments, and these departments, and they changed their names and their functions over time, but by and large what they often did was to simply shadow the government ministries, so that you had almost a parallel structure at work. Now, it's important to recognise, I think, that this structure of power in the USSR, at the top, the executive power, was essentially a collective executive. It was a body in which a number of people, and the number varied, but the maximum sort of about 25 if you count the Politburo and members of the Secretariat who weren't members of the Politburo, Central Committee Secretaries who weren't members of the Politburo. It was a collective body. This was the body which met regularly throughout the Soviet period, except for the period leading into the Second World War up until Stalin's death. It met regularly. The government didn't meet regularly. The government hardly met at all as a collective body. But this Politburo met regularly. Most of the important decisions came to that body. Certainly under Stalin, when Stalin was at his most dominant, when he was the dominant leader from 1934 until 1953, the way in which the Politburo functioned was somewhat different. Very often it was more on a one-to-one basis with Stalin rather than meeting as a body as a whole. But nevertheless, over the life of the Soviet period, the Politburo was the executive body, and it was a collective body. But the important thing to realise is that the way in which the Politburo functioned directly reflected the way in which the party leader, that is the General Secretary, or First Secretary as he was for a while, the way in which the General Secretary wished it to function. If Stalin didn't want it to meet, it didn't meet. Khrushchev often just tried to go around the Politburo, or Presidium as it was called then, and that affected the way it functioned. Brezhnev was intent on ensuring that the Politburo met in a collective fashion regularly and made all the decisions. So the way in which executive power worked in the Soviet period reflected very much the preferences of the party leader. Now, of course, this changed in 1990, because in 1990 what Gorbachev did was to restructure executive power within the Soviet Union. He introduced an executive presidency, which he then took up. He introduced a position of a deputy president, because there'd never really been an official deputy within the Soviet system. The government was now formally to be appointed by the president. And the Politburo was downgraded. Gorbachev also set up a couple of advisory bodies, Presidential Council, Federation Council, and he began to develop the presidential administration very much along the lines of the old secretariat. But of course, this structure had no time to get stabilised, because within 18 months of establishing the executive presidency, the whole thing fell over in the coup of August 1991. Now, the post-Soviet executive emerged out of this sort of situation, and it too was structured very much by the desire of the chief leader, that is, of Yeltsin. Clearly, the model of the presidency that he established was adopted on the basis, or alongside, the model of Gorbachev. So there was a president and a vice president. The president appointed the prime minister, who was approved by the legislature, and the presidential administration was developed to give the president some support. Now, this model was formalised in 1993 with the constitution, with one important change, and that important change was that Yeltsin did away with the vice presidency. So we now have a president, but we don't have a vice president. Formally, if you look at the constitution, executive power explicitly resides in the government, chaired by the prime minister. Sort of formulation, particularly when you think about the way in which everybody has argued how the constitution is a strongly presidential document that formally vests executive power in the government, chaired by the prime minister, although the president can chair the government. But of course, in practice, what we've had has been the expansion of presidential power, initially by Yeltsin, and then by Putin. Yeltsin was, clearly many people would say, a homo sovieticus. Even if he tried to get rid of as much of communism as he could, he was brought up in that system, and you could see the taint of it, if you like, on him all the way through his presidency. And what he tried to do as president was essentially to gather in significant power into the presidency in the same way that the general secretary of the party had done. But he was unable to do this. And he was unable to do it essentially because of the power of other political actors in the system and the chaos of the 1990s, and of course also because Yeltsin himself was ill, especially from 1995-96, when he's out of action for a considerable period of time. So that what you get is power effectively devolving from the Optsum into the hands of informal advisors, which is one of the things that many of the politicians didn't like, but also into the hands of potentially prime ministers. Chernomyrdin is the one who really gained significant power as a result of Yeltsin's illnesses. So Yeltsin's illness limited the way in which he could continue to exercise the bounteous powers of the presidency, but in a sense that illness just shows how important the person the president is for shaping the office. And that lesson, of course, comes to us again when we look at Putin. Because clearly, what Putin has done has been to strengthen central power within Russia. I mean, everyone now argues that since Putin came in 2000, one of his main aims was to centralise political power. And he centralised it in Moscow by weakening the federation or weakening the federal units. But he also centralised it within the presidency. And he's done this in a number of different ways, which we can talk about later. But crucial in this has been the way in which he's been able to subordinate the Prime Minister. With the possible exception of his first Prime Minister, Kasyanov, he has been able to function with essentially submissive prime ministers, prime ministers who were willing to give Putin what Putin wanted, who were willing to go along with him, who wouldn't stand up to him. Fradkov, Zhukov, and of course Medvedev. In addition, what Putin did was to strengthen the presidential administration by moving into it people who were loyal to him and by expanding the competence of it, which enabled him to have a separate line of information and potentially control into all aspects of society that he didn't have before. What we've also seen, I think, is to perhaps what may be seen as contradictory factors here. One is that he has enforced or implemented a greater routinisation of procedures within the governing system. Under Yeltsin, things were sort of a bit ad hoc, a bit chaotic, a bit unstructured. Putin has reversed that. He's been able to introduce greater routinisation, greater rules, greater regulation for the central bodies, if you like, to function by. And one effect of that, of course, is that by introducing greater routine, greater regulation, you also ensure greater oversight, because you can then see whether bodies are acting as they should not. Oh, okay, thank you. So greater routine, greater regulation, which is often seen as a way of hindering personal power, can in this case be seen as a way of enhancing Putin's personal power over the bodies that surround him and that are below him. But the other thing that he's done, which again harks back to the Soviet Union, and Yeltsin tried to do it too, is that Putin's got an enhanced personal profile, to put it mildly. What he's done, what has happened, has been clearly that there has been an attempt to develop a form of a cult around Putin. Everybody knows about the pictures of him standing with his, you know, a bare torso and holding a gun and patting the snow leopard and diving into the sea and finding the Greek amphora and flying the ultralight and leading the cranes back where they got lost when they were going on their migratory route, and so forth. We've all seen these, and what this clearly began in the early 2000s, and it was an attempt to associate machismo, sexual appeal and power. And the message was, I'm not Yeltsin. But of course, after the first term, he didn't have to make that message anymore because everybody knew he wasn't Yeltsin by then. But it's continued on. And this has clearly been an effort by Putin and or the people around him to promote this image of the leader who is necessary for Russia to go on and to achieve the greatness that he espouses for it. And if you can believe the opinion polls, it's been very successful. He's, you know, after 17 years in power or whatever it is, he's still got an opinion poll rating of about just over 80%. What this does is that it clearly enhances his position within the executive, and it clearly enhances his position within the country. So to end, what essentially I'm arguing here is that wherever you look at executive power, there is always a tension between the institutions and rules on the one hand and the individuals on the other. There's an American scholar whose first name I can't remember, but Neustadt, who wrote about the American presidency in the 1950s. Now, he basically said, if you look at the American presidency, you can understand the different presidents and the way they acted as president by looking at the person themselves. In other words, the institutions are moulded, shaped by the person who is there. And this has clearly been the case in Russia. And I think if you want another illustration of how important this is, of how important the person is, you only have to look at the US. Because Obama and Trump are Obama functioned and Trump is functioning within the same institutional structure. Nothing has changed in terms of the institutions. But the way the presidency is developing, being used and functioning is very different. And that was the case, this is my last point, and that was the case in the Soviet Union, and it is also the case within Russia.
Thank you. So, thank you very much, Graham. Now, I'd like to invite all our speakers, Milenko, Rod, Graham, grab that chair over there and bring it, please. Yes, we are running a little bit behind time, but I suggest that we maybe extend the session for 5 minutes or so. Would that be okay, Gibbon? And if people start to vote with their feet, well, then we might stop it there. Yes, of course. Yes. So, to me, there's plenty of food for thought here. From the Russian Revolution, Stalinism, globalisation, executive power and sex appeal. So, I don't know everybody's name, but let me just point to, please, and give you the floor. Yes.
Thank you very much. Just two short comments. Actually, it was very interesting discussion, and it was my pleasure that the first presentation started with Международниц, because I myself Международниц, so especially Stenaya. And from this point of view, it is also very interesting. I mean, that Soviet specialists in IR were much more influential than specialists in IR today. It is very interesting. So in times of Mirsky, they had direct contact with administration and could influence Soviet foreign policy. Now it is not the case. So it is paradoxically that they had to work in the environment when they had so many ideological points. Now we do not have it, but they were very influential and we are not. And the second point is about Graham Gill's marvelous presentation. It was really marvelous. And now there are many discussions in Russia also within the context, for example, of Politburo 2.0, Minchenko's report, etc. I'm not co-author of Minchenko, but I consulted him also when he wrote this, because many Russian political scientists participated in this. And nowadays, for example, recently there was a conference on Altai, organized by Friedrich Ebert Stiftung and Vladimir Ryshkov. And they just discussed this, so the degree of institutionalization, this new Politburo 2.0 around Putin, and what is the essence of this personal versus institutional in Putin's Russia. Because, for example, the main discussion today is who is actually ruling Russia, who is controlling Russia today. Some people say that Putin does everything personally, especially after the start of the Ukrainian crisis. Others say that Putin doesn't mean much because he is a supreme arbiter in the system of this informal Politburo. So there is a huge discussion on this, and I will be very interested in your opinion.
Okay, so there are two questions. Rob, did you want to respond to your comments?
No, I think it was the comment.
Okay, so Graham.
Yeah, thank you. That's very interesting. I mean, the Politburo 2.0 stuff is interesting. I mean, essentially what it does is it's taking sort of network analysis and trying to apply it to the to Russia. And I mean, network analysis is essentially saying who are these people connected to and trying to draw them together. And the argument is that Putin is surrounded by this diverse group of people, and they actually are diverse. I mean, they're not all Siloviki. Surrounded by this sort of diverse group of people who feed stuff into him, and he uses them to bounce ideas off. Now, whether Putin is simply an arbiter or whether he is the primary decision maker, I mean, the people who argue that Putin is basically an arbiter usually make an argument that Russian elite politics is divided between these different elite groups who are constantly fighting one another for influence. And Putin is standing above it, and he gives support sometimes to one, sometimes to another. But essentially ideas and policy conflict is situated within this whirlpool rather than within Putin itself. Now, I actually think that idea is overblown. That it's really difficult. If you ask people who make this argument, okay, who are these groups? They generally can't identify lots of people, and the basis upon which they do make their identifications is really difficult. There clearly are differences of view within the government and within the sort of circles around the government. There are major differences of view about a range of issues, foreign policy, economics in particular. Do we need to reform? Should we reprivatise some of the state corporations? Should we expand state ownership and so forth? So that there are these ideas going around, and Putin is clearly a part of that discussion. But Putin doesn't always get his way. I mean, you only have to look at the press and look at the meetings that Putin has with government ministers, and he holds these meetings quite frequently, and they're reported in the press. And you read what he says, and most of the time he's saying, "We decided that we were going to do X, and X hasn't been done. Now Y hasn't it been done?" So there's clearly a gap between the decisions that are made and what's actually being carried out on the ground, which again is very solid in its very solid. And therefore, I mean, that's a sort of a long way of saying Putin clearly has most influence, I think, but there are other political actors which also have an input into decisions. Putin doesn't make every decision, but I suspect he makes those decisions that he wants to make.
Good, thanks, Graham.
Kieran. Well, actually, if I can piggyback on Andrei's comment, but it's a question actually for all three speakers based on this discussion. So we all believe in the transformative power of ideas to some extent. So it seems to me that during Soviet times, people like Mirsky and Simonia had great impact on how the powers that they thought. The question is, was it sheer good luck or was it some kind of institutionalized process that whatever they thought about the future of socialism, the place of the Soviet Union, would not be turned down easily as kind of a whimsical thinking of some strange thing. That's the question for Rod. Again, sheer good luck or some institutionalized process of ideation or transformation. For Graham, it's pretty much the same story, but in the context of Putin, you say that the ideas are going around. Compared to the Soviet period, is it like floaters in the toilet going around, or that's a more structured discussion with the public intellectuals and think tanks having direct access to power, influencing the process very robustly? And for Milenko, it's pretty much on the same subject. Say, ideas of Stiglitz and Milanovic, they were great on paper, you know, they're bleeding hearts, but is anybody going to listen to that in the long term?
So, yes.
excuse me. Quickly, the answer is they had some influence, but not on the things that most concerned them. So Mirsky had influence over Soviet Arab policy in terms of providing some, more so perhaps than now, in terms of, it wasn't, as I understand, a supporter of current Russian policy, but that's another question. But the things that really concerned them were what was going on and what was going wrong with their own society. And of course the elite was not going to listen to that. And the comments that they made cryptically are quite both in the sense prophetic, but also extremely critical of the whole nonsense of the official dogma. Seamus, in something published in, I think, early 70s, described a system which in a sense relates to Graham's analysis, where you have a group of people, he didn't call them the Politburo, who are in a room with controls about everything, and yet they can't achieve something. That's more or less a paraphrase of what he said. The most interesting discussion occurred apparently in a review of a book about Taiwan by an old professor named Darlin Milik Settle. And in a passage there, Seamus and Mirsky together wrote something like this. They looked forward to a situation where the party would reduce control over the economy, and they wondered what might this be. They said, of course the party leaders will not themselves become industrialists, but they will allow... the title of it was The Bureaucratic Bourgeoisie. Now, I checked actually with Seamus 30 years ago, and he intimated, without saying so, because of course the room was bugged, that this was not just about Taiwan. This was about a possible development in Russia. So that it's the quality of the debate. These people were thinking forward, even in the... And that was actually published in 79, in a year of real crisis economically. They were thinking forward beyond Brezhnev as to what might happen, based on an analogy. Now, it was only an analogy, so it has that limitation. But yes, they were influential about some things, but not about things that most concern them, which is how to reform Russia. And that would be the same situation now. So I remember Mirsky's 80th birthday in the old NMO Institute. The discussion was, why has so little been achieved politically after Gorbachev? Why have they ended up where they are? So there's a lot of disappointment as well as some limited influence in the past.
Graham, you want to respond quickly?
Well, I would just say, yes, I do. They potentially do have significantly more influence than during the Soviet period, because the channels don't have to be indirect in the sort that Ron was talking about. So there is a very wide open discussion, open policy discussion within Russia now that you never had before.
Milik.
Yes, I think that people have to listen to them. I mean, not only just their bright ideas, because I consider myself a political economist, but political decisions are most important, and politicians decide the world, but economy still plays a significant role. without the economy, communism probably would not collapse, Gorbachev would not go to perestroika and glasnost. And now the world is in the deep crisis, as you know, from 2008-2009, has not been completely recovered. Greek is still in crisis. So there, these 1%, 2% are recovering, actually solving the crisis, giving us credit cards, as we know. And we are not giving us money. There is no distribution. They are giving us credit cards. And they say, so you cannot fill another credit cards. Another credit cards. And the balloon will blow up. I mean, you cannot all the time put the pressure on the other people, because this 1% cannot buy the goods. This is the basic law of economics. They have to give money to the most of the population. They cannot keep it for themselves, because they cannot buy millions of cars, houses, and so on by themselves. And they are not giving. They are giving credit cards. I mean, this is the problem.
Sort of credit balloon that might burst.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes, please. Yes.
Yes. If you are thinking or connecting this Russian topic of the panel and Russian revolution and Putin's will and wish to avoid all revolutionary changes in Russia, I think that it is true. And if you think that how he tried to do it is that he has made tremendous attempts to keep majority of population happy. And it is based on the economic development. They have had, from the early 2000s, there has been a common perspective that, okay, Russian economy is developing too well, and people's living standard is also developing. But it leads to the Russian joke, how they call the situation at the moment, that there is a competition between TV and refereeds, what is inside and do they have a food and a developing living standard. I think that this is one of the main things which can save the current system, because so much is invested to Putin's, like Graham told, invested to Putin's personality. And these presidential systems, governing, ruling systems, they are really crisis prone in the situations when there happens changes. And I'm just thinking that we don't get the full picture of the main parts of the picture of the whole development if we don't take into consideration also social strata and groups and different interest groups which are, influencing to this policy. And I think that the weakest point at the moment in Russian society is that no one actually don't know also how to get out of this crisis, global economic and social crisis. And it hits like usually during the early 20th century, before the October and the February revolutions. It hits strongly to this marginal economy like Russia, standing to the Western Europe. And I don't remember anymore who said that this way this resembles the situation before the World War First.
So I'll just take that as a comment, and if any, because we'll soon be running out of time, if any of the panelists want to respond to what you've heard.
Maybe take another couple of questions, and then we
well, if you want to proceed that way. We'll have to keep these questions short because I believe we're having an address in a few minutes. Yes?
Yeah.
Sorry, better.
The food is getting stale.
Yeah. Okay, so two quick questions and that's it.
Okay, George, thank you. Just a very quick question. This question of the greater centralization and meridianization of power that's occurred under Yeltsin, under Putin. Do you think that Putin did this because that was a conscious plan, that he actually really meant to do that, or was it this question that we were looking at in the previous session of him being an anthropological conservative?
Okay.
I mean, in a sense, did he do it because that was his instinct, or because he had a plan?
Okay, we'll stop there, and then just one quick other.
Just on the wondering if you could talk a little more about the complexities of globalisation. I mean, globalisation, as I understand it, is not a monolithic phenomenon. You can have economic globalisation, political globalisation, cultural globalisation, but these things don't necessarily always go together. And often people look to the Chinese model that you can have economic globalisation, but at the same time you can have a strong sense of nationalism and localised domestic culture and politics.
Okay.
And this is also often applied to Russia.
Okay, can I stop? Sorry to interrupt you, but yes. So, response from the panels? One, two, three, maybe.
Was it a conscious plan? Well, I think he saw the way in which the system appeared to be falling apart under Yeltsin, so he had a plan to try to remedy that. But I don't think he came in with a blueprint saying, you know, by 2012 this is what we wanted to be like. He clearly wanted to centralise power. Some of it was ad hoc. And some of it was clearly planned before, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Rob, do you want to say?
I'll just answer it with a question, which maybe we should have focused more on, which is this. Compared to the Tsarist regime in the start of 1917, how strong is the Putin regime? Now, the answer clearly is that it is significantly stronger. And that was Graham's interpretation in last August. But that how significantly? And you're suggesting that maybe it's not an overwhelming difference, depending on other factors. Like, again, you go back to Lenin in 1916. He said, we won't see the revolution. Things can change quite quickly.
Okay. Milenko.
Of course, I completely agree. I mean, globalization is not only economic globalization, it's cultural, informative, internet technology. Now we have, which make the world going together as a global village and so on. But I was speaking about the consequences of economic globalization. I mean, all of this, behind of that, somebody is collecting profit. We have Google and few bunch of young people, I mean, invented that, and they are multi-millionaires, billionaires. I mean, of course, I applaud them for their invention, but they have to share. This is the problem. I'm for Keynesian style distributive capitalism, and that existed in Western Europe. I mean, this is why Western Europe was so successful. And this is why our friend in the West, I mean, many, particularly Anglo-Saxon countries in America, first, they forgot. They think that they defeated Russian type of socialist, European, Soviet type of socialism by neoliberal market economy. No, they didn't. The Central European style of capitalism with very strong role of government and welfare state and secure life for the workers and high living standard of the workers, that defeated communism in the East. They wanted that. Gorbachev wanted that. The workers in the Soviet Union, in Poland, Hungary, wanted German style of living and German security of German workers who went on holidays. American workers have 2 weeks of holiday on average, and they don't go anywhere. While German workers go in Africa, Asia, and so on, they wanted that.
Thank you. Sorry, I'll have to stop you there. Yeah. Thank you very much, everybody. We'll continue this conversation. Okay, and now we do have a lecture, don't we? For a lunchtime lecture?
So, while we're waiting our food, we are going to enjoy the presentation by the Shadow Minister for the transpersonnel who will speak on a topic related to reform. So let's just go outside and combine material food with spiritual
food. I apologize, I didn't get to that. Actually, it was him, and actually asking you to stop him. But
we started late.
You
I wasn't watching that, I was watching my... I was... Anyway, no problem. So,